This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ is supported by Impact Grants Chicago. Over 400 women come together in a unique model of collective giving. Each member contributes $1,000, and together those donations grow into $100,000 grants for Chicago nonprofits that address critical challenges across the city. By pooling resources, individual gifts multiply into greater impact. Listeners can learn more about Impact Grants Chicago and past grant recipients at impactgrantschicago.org/join2025.
I'm Esther Yunji Kang, and this is Reset. After two decades of work, the National Public Housing Museum has opened the doors to its new permanent home on the city's Near West Side. It's fitting. The museum is located inside the only surviving building of the historic Jane Addams homes. And it's also a remnant of the late 1930s, back when there was a lot of optimism about public housing elevating the living conditions in Chicago. Now, I went to the grand opening of the museum and was impressed by the look and design of it, but also by the stories of the residents, which are embedded throughout the exhibits. Reset's architecture sleuth Dennis Rodkin also stopped by the museum and shared his impressions for the latest in our series, What's That Building?
One of the things that I think is coolest in that building is the room filled with records by people who lived in public housing. Yeah. And there are literally hundreds of record albums in there from Tammy Wynette and Dinah Washington and Eminem and Elvis Presley, all people who at some point in their lives passed through public housing in some development. Few of those I mentioned, Dinah Washington would have been in Chicago, but the others were in other cities. I think that's very cool. It just sort of gives this idea that there's this sort of cultural patrimony that actually ties to something that at the time, you mentioned the optimism, at the time we started building public housing, there was a lot of optimism about it. Then in the latter half of the 20th century, really the latter decades of the 20th century, that optimism was all drained off. So to see those record albums, I think is nice. But for the architecture part of the tour, for what we're here to talk about today, I think one of the most interesting things is, as you said, it's the last surviving building of the Jane Addams homes. Jane Addams was the first Chicago Housing Authority development completed, and there were 32 buildings. So what you're looking at now when you go there is really a stump. And no dishonor to the museum. I think it's great that this building was saved. But it's very different to see that one building than to have seen that cluster of 32.
Well, so, you know, what made you want to take this deeper dive into the design history here?
Because this was a very important point in housing history, in Chicago housing history, and also, in a sense, in Chicago architectural history, because you're talking late 30s, the Great Depression, there's really very little else being built, and yet there are these public housing developments being built, not only this one, Jane Addams, but completed around the same time were the Trumbull Park homes in Englewood and the Julia Lathrop homes in Lakeview, three big developments housing with a total of about 1,030 apartments at a time when very little else was being built.
Well, you mentioned those sort of sibling apartments that, you know, on Diversity and Clybourne and the Trumbull Park homes around 106th and 6th and the 8th. How are those designs similar and how are they different from each other?
They're similar in that, first of all, they're all red brick, and that was done intentionally. Brick was an inexpensive building material at the time, but also the idea was to knit these developments into the surrounding neighborhoods, and we have a lot of brick buildings in our neighborhoods in Chicago, but they're relatively spare or Spartan. There's not a lot of, if you look at buildings built in the 20s before building came to a halt, There is Art Deco. There's gold piping. There's terracotta, all sorts of things. These are much more utilitarian. They're kind of stripped down. But they're not just boxes. They do look sort of boxy because they were built inexpensively. But, for example, at the Trumbull Homes, there are these rows of low-rise brick buildings, but they have these great semicircular canopies that come out over the doors and these semicircular window bays so that it's not just a flat box. It has some detail. And at Jane Addams, there were these great balconies that people remember and that have been restored on that one building. So they were relatively, they looked modest, but they didn't look plain.
At the Jane Addams homes, there's a lot of courtyards, right? And, you know, that's kind of where the children played and the moms could look out the window. Can you tell us more about why those were built and the history of, you know, design like that, designing an apartment around courtyard?
Well, first of all, they're low so that there aren't elevators. But also the idea was a mother should be able to be in her apartment looking out and see her children playing and also be able to call back and forth to them, which, of course, when we get into the high-rise era of public housing, is no longer possible. So then there are these courtyards. These all three of these developments are more like campuses than like our city blocks. The grid sort of gets interrupted, and it's, in Jane Addams' case, 32 buildings, other numbers in the others, that are surrounded sort of like by a carpet of lawn and garden. So the idea is your kids can be playing in and among all that. They can mix from building to building. And we're all part of this low-rise community looking down into that or coming up from it to our apartments. Very homey, very much like a neighborhood within the larger neighborhoods they were in.
That's definitely the sense that I got from the residents that I talked to. Can you tell us more about what it was like to live in Chicago back in the late 1930s and early 1940s? Why did the creation of, quote, new modern public housing seem like such a beacon of hope?
Because people who were low income were living, in many cases, in really terrible conditions. I talked to Peter Landon, the architect who worked on the renovation of this building, but he's done a lot of affordable housing. He's really conversant with why public housing and affordable housing exist. And one thing he talked about is before these buildings come along, a lot of new immigrants are living in places where, like, you don't have a bathroom in your own apartment. It might be shared down the hall, or there might not even be indoor plumbing. It's the 1930s, but there might still not be indoor plumbing. You might have little or no electricity, might have it in only some rooms. No, they're not built for ventilation, so in the summer, it's just sweltering. Many of them falling down, haven't been maintained for years. Once again, by 1937, we're so far into the Depression that even if your building had been in relatively good shape in the 20s, there may have been a lot of maintenance that wasn't done for years. And so you're living in pretty terrible conditions. And the idea, not only with Chicago public housing, but nationwide, according to an act passed by Congress, was to fill the gap, to create housing that would catch up to population growth and the growth of lower income, the number of lower income people who needed housing, and elevate the level they were living in, provide decent housing for them rather than these slum conditions that existed in cities all over America.
Dennis, you talked with a few experts for this story, including Peter Landon. What did you learn from them about the architectural choices back then? Why did they have such a specific look?
Esther, Landon and another man, Brad Hunt, who's a professor at Loyola, who wrote a book about the history of Chicago public housing. His book is really sort of about how it turns and sours in later years, but he certainly got into the origins of Chicago public housing. And what they talked to me about was, first of all, these are going to be modern homes. We're breaking away from those slum conditions. I want to put you in something new, something that looks like it's real housing. It's not the temporary conditions. There were still people living in tents on a lot of lots in the city at that time. The idea was, at the time, public housing should be essentially just as nice as everybody else's housing, built at a more modest scale, built for less money, but provide people really decent living conditions.
Two people were credited most with the look and feel of the buildings that you just talked about. Elizabeth Wood and John Holabird. Why? Who were they?
They are, Elizabeth Wood is a fascinating character out of Chicago history. She's a social worker. She's done other things. She becomes in 1937, the first director, actually called executive secretary of the Chicago Housing Authority. And she's got this idea. She's the one who said that the building should stay low so that mothers could be in eye contact and vocal contact with their kids. She also, she had the idea that there should be spaces that she described as designed for loitering, because we're looking at a time when a lot of times the father would be off in a bar, the kids had nowhere to go but play on the sidewalk. So the idea was what we now think of as that third place, Starbucks or something like that. She wanted these designed into the public housing developments. She wanted parks, stores. She wanted these really to be another neighborhood, a new neighborhood within the neighborhood. And she stays at the Chicago Housing Authority from 1937 into the 50s. We could do another whole segment on how race is primarily the reason she ends up being pushed out. And then the other person you mentioned, John Holabird, is an architect. He was one of the heads of Holabird and Root, which was in before the Depression. They're putting up these great Jazz Age buildings, the Palmolive Building, the Chicago Daily News, 333 North Michigan, some of our great Art Deco buildings downtown. But then along comes the Depression. He and many other architects, builders, laborers are out of work. And so he becomes sort of the lead architect on these first three developments I talked about. Many other architects contributed. He's kind of the guiding light. And according to Brad Hunt, he's really sort of responsible for this kind of minimal aesthetic. He's saying, you know, we'll do them relatively modestly. We'll have some flourishes like the semicircular canopies I mentioned, but we're really going to concentrate on building well-built, solid buildings that bring people out of the poorly built, tumble-down buildings they were living in.
You know, Dennis, when I visited the museum, I really loved seeing the animal court. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Isn't that one of the coolest features? Mm-hmm. It's great that they're back. These were carved by Edgar Miller, who was really one of the great Depression era sculptors and also a home builder in Chicago. He did all sorts of fascinating work. And then he's brought in by Holabird to create a playground for the Jane Addams homes. And he carves these out of limestone. He makes a bear, a ram, wolves. And this is the playground. The kids are going to climb on, do imaginary games that involve the animals, whatever it would be. There's also a water element that when you see the old photos, it looks a lot like the water element that's at the Crown Fountain in Millennium Park now. So, you know, splash pond and the animals to climb on. And this is part of that idea that they were elevating life in these public housing developments. Your kid is outside playing, climbing around on jungle animals and pretending to be a jungle animal or whatever sort of imaginative games they'd be playing. I think that that was just really one of the greatest features of the early public housing in Chicago.
Yeah, and the artist was commissioned as part of the New Deal program to give work to struggling artists, right?
Sure. Artists like architects, builders, everybody, so many people were out of work. Let's find ways to put them to work. And giving this job to Edgar Miller was just a stroke of genius, because what resulted was great.
You mentioned sort of these low-rise buildings that became kind of a trend back then. But then it sounds like developers eventually pivoted to high-rise buildings. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, as I understand it, especially from Brad Hunt, conditions really sort of demanded that this happen, because lots of cities are building public housing. There's this crush of people moving to cities from farms, moving to Chicago from the South. There are enormous numbers of people who need housing. There's not that much land, and it's cheaper to pile people higher on that acre than to build these low-rise buildings. And President Eisenhower eventually dictates that if you're going to build public housing, you're going to build high-rises. And so part of what gets lost is this idea that the mother can be in the window looking out at her children in the playground, that you can walk up to your apartment with your groceries. Instead, you're going to go up in an elevator. And eventually, as we know, those poorly maintained elevators start to fail. Kids can't play all the way down on the ground and still be in eye contact with their parents, so they're playing in the hallways. It changes everything. It changes many things about the way people lived in public housing. And you lose that sort of homey intimate neighborhood feel that the low-rise buildings had provided.
Interesting stuff, Dennis. Before I let you go, can you tease what building you'll be looking into next?
Interestingly, we're not going to look at a building, but we are going to look at a property. I'm going about 80 miles west of the city to look at a piece of property that was recently transferred in a very historic and resonant way.
Well, that's Dennis Rodkin, Crane's Chicago Business residential real estate reporter and Reset's architecture expert. Thanks, Dennis.
Thanks, Esther.
This episode of the Reset podcast was produced by Sasha Ann Simons. It was edited by Meha Ahmad and mixed by Ethan Schwab and Micah Yason. I'm Esther Yunji Kang, and for Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.